to Spark Your Fire podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Now, here's your host, Jazz. But before that, let's listen to the quote of the week.
You guys will find that you have passions, and having a passion is a gift. I think we all have passions, and you don't get to choose them. They pick you, but you have to be alert to them. You have to be looking for them. And when you find your passion, it's a fantastic gift for you because it gives you direction, it gives you purpose. You could have a job, or you can have a career, or you can have a calling. And the best thing is to have a calling. And if you find your passion, you'll have that, and all your work won't feel like work to you.
And we have got the Bitcoin man back on the show. Has, welcome, buddy, once again.
Good to be back. How's it going, Jazz?
Not bad. Man, you have set a record. I think you're the only person so far who's been on the show these many times repeatedly. So
really?
I think I should step down and you can start hosting this now.
maybe the host a monthly Bitcoin hour. We'll see how we go.
Look, mate, anyways, I appreciate for you to come back on the show.
Likewise, thanks for having us back.
We have discussed quite a few things in the last couple of episodes that we did, and the purpose of today was basically to just touch on what the Bitcoin's monetary policy is.
Yeah.
And how it differs from the existing central bank's monetary policy, and whether it can even be compared or not, right? I'll let you explain how it works.
So after I'm done explaining how it works, you'll also get an answer to that second question, the comparison and contrast. So it'll be actively compared and contrasted during the explanation.
Mm-hmm. But so, just before we jump into the monetary policy, mate, something that has been that I've been thinking for the last couple of days or weeks. You know how in the previous episode we discussed Bitcoin versus gold and maybe even some other asset classes, right? Mm-hmm. But let's talk specifically gold for a second. Do you think it's an unfair comparison to some extent? I personally think if this thing is what it claims to be, it's way better than gold, right? And it feels like that we are underestimating the beast by comparing it to gold. I get it why people do it, to sort of relate it to the existing markets to some extent. But gold, you can't fine-tune. This thing can be fine-tuned as long as the network effect stays and people believe in it. This is way better, in my opinion. So why do we even do that comparison?
I think it's just because Bitcoin can be just so difficult to grasp. Sometimes explanation by analogy, even though it's, you know, not totally accurate, is needed. And gold is probably the most useful and near analogy. And and look, the monetary policy and distribution policy of Bitcoin can very easily be compared to gold, especially in terms of difficulty to mine and how that's been influenced by time and improvement of technology.
Okay. Let's maybe jump into the monetary policy and then we'll come back to this if required still after that.
Yep. So Bitcoin's monetary policy is extremely basic. It's based on the principle of a fixed supply with also fixed issuance based on issuance of Bitcoin per unit of time. Now, the interesting thing with Bitcoin is the unit of time isn't seconds and minutes and hours and days and whatnot. The measure of time in Bitcoin is the block.
Mm-hmm.
So it all starts with the Bitcoin block. So originally, when Bitcoin was created, not completely arbitrary, but arbitrary enough block time of 10 minutes was set. So this 10-minute time has, you know, withstood the test of time and various criticisms and all of that kind of stuff. But inertia has kind of made it impossible to change. There's lots of benefits to having a 10-minute block time, a lot of drawbacks to having a 10-minute block time, but it is what it is. So it all starts with the idea of a 10-minute block. So as we've discussed on previous shows, a block is simply a collection of transaction data.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all a block serves to purpose, and the system is designed with a target that one block is mined roughly every 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And everything builds on from there. So we had a 10-minute block time,
mm-hmm.
and then we had the arbitrary choice of rewarding 50 bitcoins per block.
Mm-hmm. So this is when it started back in 2009.
This is when it very first started.
Mm-hmm.
And then another arbitrary figure was plucked out. Every round about 4 years or so, which mm-hmm. if you break it down into minutes and seconds, average it out into 10-minute periods is 210,000 blocks.
Mm-hmm.
This reward reduces by half. So instead of getting 50 blocks per minute, we get 25 blocks per minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then every 4 years, we half this number again until you get half and half and half and half and half and half. And roughly 140 years later, that effectively tends to zero. Now, you add up all of these 50s and 25s and 12.5s and 6.25s over this 140 years, and the number turns out to be 21 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't start from 21 million and work backwards. It all started from 10 minutes and 50 coins per 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the typical premise. And this is all based on statistical averages. And I don't think ever in the history of Bitcoin has a block been produced in exactly 10 minutes. It's always either more or less.
Right.
So that's the effective policy. Now, let's take the comparison back to gold now to explain.
Sorry, just before we take the comparison back to gold, mate. So if I got this right, let me just repeat it so I fully get this. It's basically, it started with 50 coins.
Yep.
We had about three or four halvings, I think.
So far we've had three.
Three.
So we are now in the fourth reward era.
Yeah, so we're in the fourth.
Yep.
And that's producing 6.25 blocks.
Yes.
Every 10 minutes.
Yep.
Which is about 144 blocks per day.
Yep.
Thing. And with the total issuance of 21 million, that will be produced over the 140 years.
Yep. Roughly speaking, now what's happened is due to improvement in mining technology and more interest from miners, blocks become easier to find and quicker mm-hmm. to find.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, 150 years ago, you could go to Western Australia, drive around in your horse and carriage, and just find gold nuggets lying on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody caught wind of that. And wanted to get into gold and gold mining. And now to produce any gold, you need to be BHP.
Mm-hmm.
So same thing happens with Bitcoin. So the system is targeted that, it wants to find a block every 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
But every 2 weeks or so, or to be precise, 2016 blocks, the system has a look over the past 2016 blocks
mm-hmm.
and has a look at how long it took on average to solve a block.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's taken a lot quicker than 10 minutes to find a block, that means the mining difficulty is too easy for the miners.
Mm-hmm.
And the difficulty needs to be increased so that they mine a block every 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
If the look back in time looks back and finds, say, it's taking 12 minutes to find a block, that means the difficulty is too hard for the miners and the difficulty gets reduced. So every 2 weeks or 2016 blocks, the mining difficulty algorithm of Bitcoin mm-hmm. self-regulates so that we get back on that 10-minute schedule. And we are never, ever on schedule. Difficulty is either always going up, and, you know, when there's a huge price crash and, you know, causing miners to be unprofitable and leave the network, it causes block time to slow down, which means difficulty goes down. But typically speaking, over the past 4 years, difficulty increases every fortnight by between, you know, 5% and 10%.
With the difficulty adjustment that happens every 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
how do miners actually cope up with that? I mean, there's obviously a lot of miners that, which we know, do get shut down.
Yep.
Over the period of time. But yeah. Is there some sort of a, I mean, are they going by the average of the previous year or the year before to work out what the difficulty yeah. adjustment is going to be, or how does it
pretty much? Yeah. It's wholly risk based. So typically, a miner will know that they have their operational expenses, their OPEX, which is effectively electricity, rent if they're renting space in a data center. Staff, you know, the usual suspects of an operation, but they also have to plan for their capital expenditures, which is buying more mining equipment to keep up with the competition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this CapEx planning will basically effectively depend on their forecasts of what they think these difficulty adjustments are going to be. So if they overestimate it, they end up buying more hardware, which mm-hmm. Which could have its advantages and disadvantages from, you know, cash flow points of view. And, you know, if they underestimate it, they don't have enough hardware to remain competitive. So Bitcoin mining is still hands down one of the riskiest businesses in the world. And unless you're very highly capitalized and, like, prepared to ride out big patches of uncertainty, you know, that span, you know, 3 to 6 month periods, it's probably not an industry you want to get into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's fair enough. So how is there more to this monetary policy, or they are the key parts of the policy? I mean, that's
basically it. So it's fixed issuance every 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. The system consistently retargets to make sure the issuance is coming out every 10 minutes. And roughly every 4 years, or 210,000 blocks, this issuance gets halved until the issuance halves all the way down to zero, and we mm-hmm. have no more new issuance. Sometime in the early 22nd century. So for now, it's estimated to be, you know, the year 2130. But if we keep going how we're going and the difficulty keeps increasing 5% a fortnight, you know, that might come in by, you know, 15 or 20 years. Either way, most likely we won't be alive to see that day. And due to the nature of due to the asymptotic nature of the issuance, we will be near 100% of the supply in, you know, 20 to 25 years time, with that last 1% taking, you know, the last, you know, 60 or 70 years to come out. So in terms of total issuance, you know, we're almost 90% into the distribution now. I think the last halving a few weeks ago, or last month in May, marked the 87.5% mark of issuance. So we're probably somewhere like 88% issuance now. You know, by the time the next halving hits, we'll be at, you know, close to 95% issuance. The halving after that will be 97.5. The halving after that will be, you know, 99, then 99.5, then 99.75, and just that last 1% will just take a very long time. So, and that's basically the monetary policy. So, like, you could have a reasonable guess to within, you know, plus or minus 20,000 bitcoins, what the total supply is going to be on, you know, June 24th, 2090. I could tell you, like, with pretty good accuracy what it's going to be. Whereas I can't tell you with good accuracy in the year 2090, 24th of June 2090, what the supply of Aussie dollars is going to be, or what the supply of USD, or even what the supply of gold is going to be.
So that's...
Whereas with Bitcoin, I can tell you with almost certainty, even 70 years into the future, plus or minus 10 or 15,000 Bitcoins out of 20-odd million, what the supply is going to be. And that's a very rare trait.
You know the policy in advance, which means you can kind of predict a lot of things based on that policy. If the policy doesn't change, here's the question though, right? Is there anything within this policy that we have discussed so far that can be changed and has the possibility of getting changed?
Look, everything can be changed and has the possibility of being changed. But at a particular cost. So I'm pretty sure somebody could decide to change the limit to 42 million Bitcoin. This would cause a hard fork. And whoever wants to play on the 42 million chain can play on it. And whoever wants to stay playing on the 21 million chain can stay playing on it.
So you're talking similar to what happened in...
With the Bitcoin Cash and... Yeah. So, but to get consensus for people already holding coin to, like, change the supply, like, it's not something that will achieve consensus. It will result in a forked coin. So organic Bitcoin as we know it and love it now, we're stuck with it.
Yep.
So there's some shortcomings, you know, that people don't like, but like it's now the nature of the beast. To get anything materially changed, especially like the supply, you know, one of the foundational linchpins being, you know, a known and fixed supply, it'd be impossible to find consensus. It would result in Bitcoin forking, and from just pure economic incentives alone, it'd be difficult to find somebody who would agree to a 50% dilution effectively, unless it's forced upon someone. Just from game theory alone, you wouldn't be able to convince someone to dilute themselves 50% to achieve consensus for a change. You will have a contentious fork. So in terms of Bitcoin as we know it, its monetary policy changing, that's effectively a zero likelihood. You know, tweaks here and there to, you know, particular algorithms. There's always improvements and changes and updates being made which achieve consensus. But if there's something that's very contentious, most likely it'll result in a fork.
So how do you compare it to, I mean, this policy obviously can be audited looking at the code base. How do you compare it to something like central bank's monetary policy, mate, which is very different? And just before you jump into that part of it, this is still inflationary. It's not deflationary.
Bitcoin, yes, yeah. Still inflationary and still inflationary in a big way. Or not in a big way, it'll be similar levels of gold inflation at the next halving.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that how the current monetary base is being expanded by printing all that money.
Oh, yes, yes, of course. Yeah.
This, you can argue, is issuing new coins every 10 minutes. It may not be as aggressive as the current monetary policy of the central banks, yep. but it's still inflationary.
Yeah, for now. So that's it's inflationary in nature, but it's a predetermined and agreed upon distribution. So everybody knows the rate of inflation. So everybody knows that for this next 4 years, the rate of Bitcoin inflation is 1.68%.
Mm-hmm.
And in the next 4 years, it's going to be 0.88% inflation. And then in the next 4 years, it's going to be 0.44% inflation. Then eventually inflation becomes zero and you're stuck with 21 million coins. So inflation is just in the nature of the beast to get these coins distributed. So it's not effectively brand new coins. It's just coins appearing out of the 21 million fixed allotment,
mm-hmm.
if that so makes any sense.
Yeah,
whereas so with fiat, we don't know what the upper limit is.
Yeah.
We don't know what the inflation might be in the future. So that's why I can tell you in 2090, I can tell you what the supply of Bitcoin will be, because I know the inflation schedule between now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certain of it to within, you know, plus or minus, 0.1%. I could get you the exact supply, because obviously you have the randomness in the 10-minute intervals that I wouldn't know how to deal with perfectly. But again, I could tell you plus or minus, 10 or 20,000 Bitcoins, what the supply is going to be in 70 years' time.
Sure. Yeah.
You can't really put your hand on your heart and say that about any other asset or commodity in the world. Not gold, not fiat currency, not properties, not cars. It's complete supply uncertainty.
Can you please not bash property? And you can bash whatever else you want, right?
Sure, but true, yeah. I'll give you an example with property. We might get the whole, like the city of Sydney might completely get rezoned,
mm-hmm.
and anyone that has a house can put 10 units on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that has huge supply implications.
Yeah, so basically,
but will the city of Sydney get rezoned? I don't know. Will some suburbs get rezoned? Yeah, possibly. Will Mulgoa, be allowed to go from like regular subdivision to like heavy density residential? Who knows? Maybe if they get a train line, all the way out there, it might be. But there's sort of uncertainty surrounding everything in life. Except really Bitcoin.
If it works.
So even if it doesn't work, so let's say it doesn't work, but I insist that it works. Right. There'll be a period of maybe like 2 years where you only find one block because I'm the only miner in the world mining.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll eventually find that block and then the difficulty will readjust. And then I'll find a block every 10 minutes and Bitcoin keeps going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair enough.
So it might not work like as a market and all of that kind of stuff, but as a technology, as long as somebody is mining Bitcoin, and I guarantee you there'll be museums that will decide to mine it if it dies, you'll have guaranteed supply.
So one of the things that you mentioned about the existing central bank's policy compared to BTC is there's no upper limit, right? Yep. Anything else that you – I mean, there's a lot of stuff different that I can think on fly.
Well, it's not just upper limit. It's it's also the random inflationary nature. So mm-hmm. random injections and pumps like we had now, like huge injections – in the trillions of just out of the blue pumped in money,
mm-hmm.
You've got randomness in interest rates. So could you tell me hand on heart what the interest rate's going to be in 5 years?
Yeah, it depends upon the president.
Could you tell me what it's going to be in 2 years? So a bank will give you a 2 year fixed interest or 5 year fixed interest.
Mm-hmm.
But even at the bank, they won't have their hand on heart and say, I know what this interest rate is going to be in 5 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's randomness in everything in the legacy system. So just supply shocks, just from bouts of printing like we've had now, we've have interest rate uncertainty, foreign exchange uncertainty, upper limit uncertainty. The whole system is effectively uncertain. So a few years ago, probably before the money printer really started firing up and like the money printer genie got released out of the bottle. So for example, I'll give props to Australia and the Reserve Bank. We didn't print for we printed for the first time in history with Corona. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to resist the temptation. So what I mean by printing is direct printing by the Reserve Bank. So sure, it was only $80 billion, which is, you know, chump change compared to, you know, some of the printing the rest of the world did.
Mm-hmm.
But the tool has now been used.
Yeah.
And if you've used the tool once, that's it. The tool's not going back in the toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't be certain that the RBA won't do monetary policy again. Governments will always do their fiscal policy, but now we can't be guaranteed that the RBA won't print. But growing up, we were always under that illusion that, you know, it's 2% inflation every year.
Mm-hmm.
That's the right amount of inflation. If you look at the things that matter, inflation has been far, far, far greater than 2% a year. A website I always recommend to people is WTF Happened in 1971, which was the year we went off the gold standard. And you can have a look at the difference between, you know, what they reckon CPI is versus the difference in everything else in terms of, you know, asset growth and various other things. But, you know, we're sort of sold the lie that we have certainty around, you know, 2% inflation every year, but that's a lie in its own right, and effectively, like, nothing is verifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I wanted to go verify, like, the inflation figures, I can't.
Yeah, fair enough. That I think explains the policy pretty well. I think the important thing that you mentioned in there was, personally for me, is that if the policy changes, then it's not Bitcoin, it's another coin, like Litecoin or whatever it is, right? So, if you want to fork a chain and start that and try it out, by all means, it's open source code, but this still remains as is the policy of it. Is it fair to say that Bitcoiners really, without even considering it, start bashing some of the other projects, which probably are still legit projects? Whether they will survive or not is a different story, but they help the ecosystem grow, and it's a little bit unfair to bash those projects, even to some extent, like Ethereum or, I don't know, picking up random Chainlink.
So this is how the militant ones think of it, and I consider myself militant, so we'll use a military example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 11 years ago or whatever it was, Satoshi decided it was enough and it was time to invade fiat land.
Mm-hmm.
So he found a nice little beach and he flew over and he dropped some paratroopers down onto the beach to make a beachhead. And these were the Bitcoiners. Mm-hmm. So the first of the soldiers were, you know, as when an army always makes an invasion, they always send in the Army Corps of Engineers first.
Mm-hmm.
They do all the mine clearing. They set up the bases. They set up the logistics, all of that kind of stuff, and they set up a beachhead. So the early developers set up this, you know, military beachhead You have, you know, some of them working on offensive capabilities, you know, building their cannons and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. People working on, you know, defensive capabilities like privacy, security, hardware wallets, all of that kind of stuff. And later on, foot soldiers like me started joining the battle. So, all right, I'm a civil engineer, but I'm not an engineer in this context. So I can't help out with the Bitcoin engineering efforts. Mm-hmm. But what I can help out with is the Bitcoin defensive efforts. And to help out with those efforts, it's as easy as going to get a sandbag, filling mm-hmm. it with sand, and throwing it on the sandbag wall.
Mm-hmm.
So I fill my bags financially and ideologically and stack this wall high to make Bitcoin stronger, to make this war feasible and give us a chance of winning this war against fiat and central banking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's happened is while I'm trying to fill out my sandbags in the sand pit is I've got all these, you know, weirdos building sand castles in my sand pit mm-hmm. and like bragging to each other, oh, look how cool my sand castle is. And these are what we call the shitcoin projects. So all we ask for these people is either help us win the fiat war or mm-hmm. get out of our sandbox. Like, you're distracting the war effort. Like, you're costing us precious time. So either help Bitcoin succeed, destroy what we've come here to destroy, and then go focus on your, you know, your interesting decentralized data storage projects. Like, no one cares. There's a far more important battle to be fought and won at the moment, and mm-hmm. you're taking away precious financial and engineering resources from the main war effort. So, for example, from the Scambrian explosion in 2017, mm-hmm. tens of billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of engineering hours of effort have been completely wasted, gone to zero, have been useless. Mm-hmm. If those were all dedicated to Bitcoin, who knows where we could have been. We might not have even been in a crisis right now.
Do you think Bitcoiners think what the world will look like on the other side if Bitcoin succeeds in terms of, or the transition period? To me, it looks like if it does what it's here to do, which is destroy the existing system to some extent, then it can get real ugly real fast.
Yeah, it can. So we've already seen what a collapse of a system looks like. So there are some pockets in America now where the system is collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those things, it's a cop-out answer, but it's one of those sort of wait and see kinds of things. So hopefully what everyone is hoping for is a slow, gradual transition where the system, quote unquote, integrates Bitcoin and Bitcoin economic and ideological thought.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, governments become smaller. And decision-making becomes more local. So, for example, decision-making at the council level starts becoming more important than decision-making at the state level because, you know, what works for Parramatta might not work for Chatswood, might not work for Bankstown, and so on and so forth. Look, it's going to be it's all a very big experiment. We've identified a root problem. Mm-hmm. which is money printing and modern monetary mechanics.
Yep, MMT.
We propose an economic solution through Bitcoin, but other social solutions will also need to crop up to meet all needs, but a lot of the Bitcoiners, myself included, firmly believe that if you solve the economic root problem, mm-hmm. the social root problems will solve themselves as well. So you see now, especially like in America,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of fighting, and the fight is, you know, left versus right.
Yep.
And that's a fantastic distraction because the proper fight is up versus down. And as soon as you can help out the side that is down and empower the side that is down to close up that equality gap between up and down, mm-hmm. I think the left and right issues solve themselves quite a bit.
It's more that it's trying to separate the money from the state, essentially.
Effectively.
Yeah.
But that's the two are almost inseparable.
At this point, they are.
Because the state's power comes effectively, you know, from the printing press.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got, you know, how many people on JobKeeper and JobSeeker. You know, this is a measure of government power to be able to keep people employed and, you know, not starving and to keep the economy going. The state uses its power of the printing press to push things along. So if the state didn't have if there was separation of money and state, things like JobKeeper and JobSeeker will be very, very hard to get over the line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in saying that, if you had separation of money and state, you'd probably have a lot more equality. Now, what I mean by equality isn't that everybody has the same amount of money. What I mean by equality is like the statistical normal distribution,
mm-hmm.
where you have one standard distribution of people that are like extremely poor, one standard distribution of people that are extremely rich.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the middle of the curve. So 68% of people, extremely strong middle class. So when you have a nice and fair distribution of resources, the middle class is an extremely generous class. All you have to do is look at, you know, annual global charitable giving. And it's usually people in the middle class that are giving the most money. So if you empower the middle class even more and enrich them even more, I do believe you'll start seeing voluntary social welfare between each other. So if you have a look at countries, so for example, in the Middle East, I've known of examples firsthand, Egypt and Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
There is no money to separate from the state. The state is broke.
Mm-hmm.
So the people are helping each other with Corona. The middle class and the rich are helping the poor. There's big, like, huge, like, food drives. Like, few people are starving. Like, society, if you've got a good social moral fabric, like society is taking care of each other.
Sorry, how does the Bitcoin solve this problem when 88% of the issuance is already there and the number of people that own Bitcoin is probably less than, I don't know, maybe 10%?
So this is how it solves it.
Yeah.
So this is how it solves it. So let's say I was very, very early into Let's say I'm Satoshi.
Mm-hmm.
I know Aussies love taking credit for being Satoshi. Let's pretend I'm Satoshi.
Mm-hmm.
And I have 1 million coins. And you do it. I buy your house off you for 100 Bitcoins.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, no, house is worth something. Let's just say I hire you to be my photographer. Follow me around.
Mm-hmm.
And photograph me.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a great photographer, and I pay you 100 Bitcoin a day. Mm-hmm. After a couple of years, or so 100 Bitcoin a day, so that's what? That's like, you know, 30-odd thousand Bitcoin a year. So my balance has dropped by 30,000 just paying mm-hmm. you as my photographer. Now, I've hired another guy as well to walk my dog. I pay him 100 Bitcoin a day.
Mm-hmm.
So I've hired all of these people, and I'm like, my yearly outgoings of spending is mm-hmm. like 100,000 Bitcoin a year. If I'm mm-hmm. not re-earning Bitcoin, after 10 years, I have no Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Yeah. No one can print anymore to give it to me for free. Like what happens with the billionaires that just keep getting richer and richer and richer. Unless mm-hmm. I'm proving work mm-hmm. through mining, or mm-hmm. proving work through services and products to other people, mm-hmm. once my Bitcoin's gone, it's gone forever, and it's redistributed. So from there, you've spent some of the Bitcoin that I've given you. My dog walker spent some of the Bitcoin that, you know, I've paid him, and so on and so forth. And eventually, unless you're adding value to people, your Bitcoin's gone. It's distributed. Mm-hmm. So this distribution is probably going to take a good 60 to 70 years, but it's going to get distributed. And eventually the people that work hardest for it, or, you know, produce the best product or service or add the most value, will accrue the most of it. And they'll be at that, you know, one standard deviation to the, you know, far right of the mean. And the people that can't keep up will be at the left side of that bell curve. Mm-hmm. And the people on the right and in the middle, you know, voluntarily help out the people on the left, because it's important to the fabric of society that, you know, there's no extreme poverty.
Mm-hmm.
I think having a very strong middle class, you know, with few ultra wealthy people and few extremely poor people, just as nature intended, as the bell curve intends, people move, you know, to the left and the right of the mean of this bell curve, depending on nature and the randomness of life. So I could also have 100,000 bitcoins today and I lose my private key. And just, you know, because of natural randomness, I've moved from the extreme right of the bell curve to the extreme left of the bell curve.
Fair enough.
But the key is that once it's spent forever. It's not like bankers can go and lose billions and trillions. You just print new money and give it to them.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully it does the transition peacefully, if that's what it's here to do, without causing much chaos. There's already a lot of chaos that we are seeing.
I think it's going to be top. It's going to be hard to top, like, the organic chaos in the world. I think Bitcoin will be a breath of fresh air for many. Yeah. Like, it's much easier to fight the system by just buying Bitcoin and, you know, trying to pick up a gun and, like, occupy a city block in Seattle.
Yeah, it's a peaceful protest.
It's extremely peaceful, extremely easy, and it's effective. Yeah. And if you're in it for a protest for ideology alone, then as a side benefit, you might even pick up some wealth as a result of this protest.
Yeah. No.
If you're looking at it as protest only. So which protest also allows you to possibly make money off the side if your protest succeeds?
Fair enough. That's a pretty good way to end it, mate. I think we should wrap this up. We are already at 45 minutes. We thought the monetary policy would only take 10 minutes to discuss. This has dragged on a bit longer, but it's a good discussion. I really enjoyed it once again. Do you want to say anything before we wrap this up in terms of the monetary policy, or?
No, that's about all. It's pretty straightforward. Fixed amount on a fixed issuance schedule, where the schedule is denominated in blocks and not hours or minutes. So it's as basic as that, really.
Awesome. As I love having you on the show, mate.
No, my pleasure.
And we'll pick up another chapter for next time, whatever that chapter is that you can help us cover. Awesome.
Definitely.
And to the listeners, hope you guys enjoy the content. And if you do, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and let the word spread like a fire. Spark your fire. Cheers. Jazz.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.